Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. As a CodeNet control, you'll also hear John, KC2WGB. John and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crowd that meets most Sunday evenings for the last 30 years, would you believe, to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. It's a gathering of the clan in which we try to teach each other how all this hardware works. How can I make that antenna work better? Does it really have to be quarter wave or half wave? Can I reflect signals off of the wall of my room on my third floor apartment building, so to speak? Questions like that frequently get answered here. The price is right. The accuracy is usually high, but not 100%. Occasionally errors are made, but they get corrected by way of the website that you can visit where you can listen to the last 6.5 years of Technical Net. You go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and there's a very nice website run by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, in which all of the past TechNets are recorded, and the ones that were more than a year ago are even documented as to what subject was being discussed during each 10 minutes. There's a lot of information there. Let me drop it. The way that TechNet is usually run is that we take check-ins in the beginning. For people who do have a question or a comment, you need not check in just because you're listening. After 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. We take those questions in order, and we give people at least a brief answer during that first hour or so. Our promise is that we try to give people at least a brief answer during the first hour. Therefore, no one who checks in has to wait longer than an hour to get an answer. After that, John goes to KC2WG, goes to the mailbag of people who don't yet have their ham license or don't have 2-meter equipment where they can talk to us directly. Let me drop. The TechNet is by which people come together and they get answers on the spot, verbally asked questions. In the case of the people who don't yet have a license and are getting their license and send an email or a snail mail to John, a few of those, 2, 3, 4, depending on what kind of interesting questions, we answer those. After that, Paul, WS2N, who for the last 10 years or so has been keeping close track of what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. So he gives us a report of what's the latest on what Curiosity is doing, for instance, that Mars Science Laboratory that's roving around Mars right now looking for life and what is it discovering. So he gives us information of things like that. After that, with the time that's left over, we sometimes go into deeper subjects like what does a radio wave really look like and are we properly representing it. I've done some experiments on what a microwave oven really does with a chocolate bar, and the answers are very different than the previously reported results. So there's a lot more going on than the first meets the eye, and I may get into some of that information. We may even get into what does a Geiger counter really see. In my opinion, a Geiger counter, at least the Geiger Mullen type, consists of an anode and a cathode tube with a high voltage between the two, and when a nuclear particle goes streaming through, it creates an ionized path that creates an electronic click. An amplifier amplifies those electronic clicks, integrates and rectifies them, presents them to a meter and to, in some cases, a loudspeaker. But there's a problem with a Geiger counter, and that is that amplifier that's amplifying those very delicate clicks out of the Geiger-Mullen tube is a radio frequency sensor.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That the amplifier inside of the Geiger counter is a radio frequency sensitive circuit. So if you're trying to measure nuclear energy at the same time that RF energy is present, you can easily get the mixed results because you're not quite sure which kind of signal the amplifier is responding to. One possible way of resolving that would be to use the loudspeaker, because the nuclear particles have got a very characteristic click, whereas the RF energy being picked up by an amplifier wouldn't necessarily give that same kind of clicking sound. So just look looking at a meter movement might not be enough. A little bit of information as to what we might get into much later on tonight. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. And if so, you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means that you do require that kind of response. A typical check-in might be N2EO, Rich and Yes. So give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW.
N2XCN.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I heard Wes, and who was the other person that Wes doubled with? Go ahead.
W2BMP, yes.
Mr. Baker Mike Papa, your name, sir, is?
Joe.
Very fine, Joe. So we got Joe and Wes. Who else wants to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
Very fine, Neil. Is that Charlie Mike Quebec?
Yes.
Fine, Neil. Okay. Joe, Wes, Neil. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KD2CXK, Craig, yes.
WS2N, Paul, Space Report. Good evening, sir.
Very fine, Paul. And Craig, is that Kilo Delta 2, Charlie, X-ray Kilowatt? Is that true, Craig? Craig?
That's correct.
Okay. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. Quite a few people are probably out celebrating the holiday, and there's more than enough to get started. Joe, W2, Baker Mike Pop-Up, go right ahead. What would you like to talk about tonight? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening. I'm interested in manufacturing a homebrew dipole for a QRP station. And what I'm wondering is there any effect as to the type of wire that I use? In other words, the material that's used in the wire. Do you have any recommendations for that?
So I see it, the materials that make the dipole up and the way you mount it, 90-some-odd% of that consideration is physical. Is it strong enough? Will it overcome the tension? If something bends it by mistake and be bent back without getting a fatigue failure? Most of the materials used in a dipole are purely mechanical and aesthetic. Does it look pretty? Does it get tarnished and whatever? As far as radio is concerned, the radio signal going down that dipole, all it really cares about is what is the conductivity of the materials. So if it's made out of copper, no problem. And in some cases, the copper, in the case of a short dipole, and maybe not even a short one, can be 30-gauge wire, and you get a little bit of extra loss. Now, when I say conductivity, I mean overall cross-sectional conductivity. I'll explain what I mean by that. It's pretty well known that aluminum doesn't have as much conductivity as copper. But as long as the aluminum rod or wire or whatever that makes up the dipole has a large enough diameter so that the total resistance is low enough, then you can even use steel if it's large enough in diameter. Be careful of stainless steel, though, because stainless steel and nichrome wire is often used to make a wire-wound resistor, and stainless steel, some of the alloys of stainless steel have an amount of resistance that's not too different from nichrome wire. I fell into that trap once. I literally made a dipole out of stainless steel. We had to endure a fairly severe environment. We needed tough materials. And the stainless steel itself, of the dipole, and that's, in this case it was a sheet metal kind of a dipole, and the stainless steel had more than enough width so that the resistance was low enough, and the dipole itself was very efficient. The problem was that we were making a very simple point contact connection to the stainless steel by way of a little bit of a finger, a copper finger from a printed circuit board. And because it had a very small point contact on a resistive material, the nearby resistance of the stainless steel gave us a fair amount of grief. So once we launched the signal into the stainless steel, the The rest of the length of the dipole worked like a charm, but the point of contact was troublesome. So, depending on how you're going to connect your transmission line to the dipole is something else you got to worry about. Are there dissimilar metals that are going to build up a corrosion and therefore start making a poor contact? I'll give you an example of that. The 6-meter Yagi antenna that I used when I first got on 6 meters was made out of aluminum conduit tubing for the elements. 1.5 inch, as I remember, aluminum tubing for the boom. And the aluminum elements were set up such that the driven element was a gamma match. The gamma match was also made out of aluminum, the rod that was the impedance match to the driven element. But I then had a copper strap around the aluminum tubing that was the gamma match rod, and that in turn connected to the center conductor of the coax cable. The shield of the coax cable connected to a grommet that grounded itself to the boom. And it turns out that within about 6 months, the dissimilar metals between the copper strap on that aluminum tubing and the aluminum itself built up a white pasty mess, powdery mess, that gave very scratchy contacts where the characteristics of the dipole would change as I transmitted, and it arced through this powder, if you know what I mean. It behaved differently on a dry day versus a wet day, and so on. So copper and aluminum coming in compression contact with each other out in the weather are going to give you grief. Let me drop. Once I recognized the problem, I went and looked at a table of dissimilar metals. There's a whole list of metals, dissimilar materials, and depending on how far apart on the list your two materials are, determines how much of a voltage is developed between the two when they're starting to act like a battery, because there's something like a salt water in between the two, so to speak. And I found out that copper and aluminum were very far at the opposite end of the chart. Very strongly recommended that you don't put them together. However, copper and solder were thoroughly compatible. Solder and aluminum were thoroughly compatible. So what I did is to take the copper strap, tin it with solder, the inner surface of that aluminum strap, tin it with solder, so that now there was a solder contact between the copper and aluminum, put it all back together, and it worked for the next 4 years with no problem. So there are solutions when you run into it, but as you can tell, resistivity and aesthetics and dissimilar metals, these are the main things you're going to be considering. I'm kind of curious as to your manufactured QRP dipole. Is that going to be for 2 meters or 6 meters or 10 meters? Back to you, Joe. W2, Baker Mike Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the optimum band that I would like would be 20 meters, and I was just wondering if there was any effect on the gauge of the wire. Again, this is QRP, backpacking kind of stuff, so weight is a consideration. Aesthetics doesn't play into it because I'm just going to hang it from a tree, but I was just wondering if the type, you know, so much percentage of copper or a copper alloy or the gauge of the wire would affect the efficiency. Again, keep in mind QRP, it's very important that the antenna be as efficient as possible.
When it comes to what you've chosen materials, whether it be copper clad, in other words, stainless steel, a steel core for strength with a copper on top, or whether pure copper, annealed copper, steel itself, aluminum, the materials themselves, you look at the right chart for that gauge of wire, you can easily find out how many ohms per 1,000 feet it has of resistance. That's your very first clue as to whether or not it's going to make a good 20-meter dipole. And if the resistance from one end to the other of the wire itself was, let me pick a number, 1 ohm, and you're building an antenna where the dipole at the center is going to have an impedance of around 73 ohms, 1 ohm of resistive loss compared to 73 ohms is going to be giving you a 98% efficiency, so to speak. There's one slight catch to this, and that is, what your ohm meter measures gives you a strong clue, but there's also something called the skin effect. At 20 meters, by way of charts you can go to, an equation you can go to, skin depth. Because of the so-called skin effect, RF energy at radio frequencies only travels on the skin, only on the outer surface of the conductor. It doesn't penetrate the center like the real current that your DC ohmmeter will see. So therefore, if you measure 1 ohm, radio-wise, maybe it's going to be 2 or 3 ohms. But still, there's ways you can measure, calculate, look it up, and so on. And as long as the resistive component of the materials you use are small compared to the impedance that you're running, 73 ohms, then you're going to get reasonably high efficiency. And so that allows you, in the case of a guy who's building, let me drop it. To a guy who's intentionally building a stealthy antenna, in other words, his landlord has says you're not going to put any antennas on this apartment building, and he, the ham radio operator, decides he's going to use 40-gauge wire so that it's invisible, and maybe, I said 30-gauge wire because it's invisible, but it's going to be strong enough, and he hangs that vertically or horizontally on the outside of the building at the third floor, so to speak, of the outside of his brick building. That could be, to the human eye, pretty invisible, and 30-gauge wire, you and I could look it up, and maybe you're going to find out that you're going to lose, because of resistance of that very skinny wire, you're going to lose 1 dB of your energy, which turns out to be something like, I think it's either 5 or 10%. Well, 5 or 10% is going to be, if it was 1 dB down, and each S unit on your signal strength meter on your receiver is 6 decibels, it might be an extremely good compromise. Again, for portable reasons, a small amount of loss in the antenna, but yet it is very easily packed up, transported in a small backpack, easily deployed in the field. There's compromises here. No antenna runs 100%. A really good antenna will run 99.9%, so to speak. An acceptable antenna is going to run 90 to 95% efficiency. So it doesn't have to be perfect. But the amount of imperfection can be quantified by an ohmmeter, by a chart, and by real measurement. Let me drop. You would think that to measure the efficiency of the antenna, you'd put it on a perfect antenna range and measure how well it performs compared to a standard antenna. Well, the number of antenna ranges that give you very high accuracy at 14 megacycles is very few. I can make 2 consecutive measurements on the exact same dipole on an outdoor 14 megacycle antenna range, and because the ground is slowly drying out as the wind blows, and the sun is rising, and the amount of ground reflection is changing, I can easily get half a decibel of change in signal strength on that antenna range when I make the exact same measurement on the exact same dipole 10 minutes apart. So you've got to be a little bit careful. You would think that measuring the antenna like that would be the way to go. Not necessarily. The real way to do it is conservation of energy. Put 100 watts into the antenna, for instance. It doesn't have to be 100. Maybe you can do it with 10 watts. But you put some amount of power into the antenna for, let's say, 3 solid minutes, 5 solid minutes, depending on what you believe is the thermal time constant of the materials involved. Run a key down for some amount of time. Turn the transmitter off, run over there and touch everything real fast. Anything that's wasting energy, the only mechanism by which it can waste energy is either by standing wave ratio, and you can measure that, or by turning your valuable RF energy into heat. If the thing that you call antenna or the circuit that you care about where you're measuring its efficiency, if it runs ice cold at a known amount of power, like 10 watts, then right away you can find out what the efficiency is. And by way of fancy non-RF sensitive thermal detectors, you can find out exactly how hot portions of the antenna are while it's operating. So as you can tell, a crafty ham radio operator has a zillion ways he can confirm the efficiency of his materials. So,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Although that's not the whole answer, at least you know more of the ingredients of what to measure, what to look for your particular application. And how soon do you think you're going to have a deliverable product there, Joe? W2BMP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, thank you for the answers. At least it gives me in the right direction, and I've already experimented with a bunch of different materials, different gauges, wires, using my Electrocraft KX3. and I do seem to find somewhat of a difference, but again, as you explained, the efficiency of the antenna could change from hour to hour, if I heard you correctly. So I'll keep plugging in it, and I'll report back to you, let you know what I found.
Yeah, the antenna changing from hour to hour, most of the time, is not the antenna, it's the environment. When you think you're making an antenna measurement, the gain of the antenna, or the effective radiated power of the antenna, you think you're measuring the antenna, you're really measuring the antenna and all the environment around the antenna. Did somebody move a reflective object? Did you, the reflective object called human being standing on the antenna range, did you move? Did you move any of the instrumentation? Did the ground reflection dry out? Did the wind blow the trees in a different direction so that the leaves are flapping another way? There's a zillion things that can go wrong. On a real outdoor antenna range, to get repeatability of the results within half a decibel is difficult. It takes heroic procedures of something called a ratiometry antenna range, which, by the way, you can read about in the February issue, 1978, I think it was, February 1978, QST Magazine, Ratiometry Antenna Range, an Outdoor Range Improvement Procedure, by some guy called K2RIW. He wrote that article, and you'd be amazed how many commercial outdoor antenna ranges, in military outdoor antenna ranges, Air Force antenna range, for instance, at Rome Air Development Center, are now using that procedure. So I'm pretty sure it was the February issue, not positive. Pretty sure it was 1978, not positive, but it was by K2RIW, so by way of the QST archives, you can look that up, do a search on those call letters, they'll find that article for you, and that'll give you hints as to what you've got to do to improve the accuracy of an outdoor antenna range, if that's what you want to do. And with that procedure, you can get the resolution of the antenna range down to a 20th of a dB, 0.05 dB, with that ratiometry technique.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With that ratiometry antenna range, you're not measuring one antenna, you're measuring two antennas side by side and comparing the results between the two. One is a so-called standard, one is the antenna under measurement, and by comparing the two, you're really converting your outdoor antenna range into one very large operational amplifier, and the common mode rejection, high common mode rejection characteristic allows you to literally wipe out the change in ground reflection off the soil that's on that outdoor antenna range. So there's ways you can improve the procedure if you want to, and it doesn't require a zillion dollars to do it, as you can tell, Joe. Good luck with that project. Come back with us in the future weeks and tell us how it's going and what you discovered. Wes, go ahead with, I think your question's going to be possibly on the subject of the radio sensitivity of a radiation detecting meter. I know this is one of the things that a number of people have fallen into a trap on this one, where they didn't realize that a Geiger counter, for instance, is in many cases radio sensitive, and therefore can sometimes give ambiguous results if you're not simultaneously using the loudspeaker. But as I said, I'm just making a guess, and maybe you've got another brief subject to be discussed. WX2N, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yes, Jackson, I have two subjects. One is using a new kind of an antenna that I don't believe was ever written in any literature, and I did it. And the second one is Geiger. Well, at first, I have established experimentally that that could not be a contamination with the radio waves when the transmitter is off. So when you have a show of the activity of the compound after the transmitter is off, then definitely that could not be a contamination. Also, the device that I have used is a perfect card of Faraday cage and is kind of immune to that. No, the antenna. I was using... the glass tube of somewhere 45 millimeters long and 5 millimeters in diameter, actually it was 475. And inside that tube I had a mixture of cadmium, phosphorus and copper. And that was about 30 milligrams of the mixture. There was a copper from one side and there was a zinc on the other side. I happened to find out by accident that this thing works pretty well as an antenna for 70 centimeters, and I have made a number of QSOs with it. The current output that was going out of the output of Kenwood 2000 was about 3 feet long, with a very, very short lead, long enough to just connect to the ends of the brass fittings, closing the tube. So that's what I found. I don't believe that there would be any doubt of the any device that is used to measure the radioactive emission and could be confused with the radio waves, because it does have a circuitry when transceiver is off. I have also used the speaker. If you have noticed that the low sound of the material that I was supporting with, like a something very low, it was a speaker system. So, back to you, and to the ship.
There's a characteristic clicking sound you get from nuclear radiation being picked up by a Geiger counter. And that characteristic clicking sound, I didn't hear it, but maybe it was there. And yes, the clicking sound becomes a broadband rushing noise when the number of counts per second becomes very high. And so I think you're saying that the Geiger counter did read upscale during the time that the transmitter was turned off. In other words, there was apparently no RF energy. And the next thing you got to worry about is, was the meter experiencing any kind of a DC offset drift characteristic? If you picked up the Geiger counter and moved it to a different location, did it stay uprange? In other words, when you actually aim the Geiger counter of the glass tube with the materials inside, when you wave the Geiger counter back and forth across that tube versus other things in the room, did it only read upscale at the right time? That's another thing that would be confirming that it's coming from what you think it's coming from. Sounds like an exciting set of measurements, but for people to accept it, a number of other tests to confirm that it's not something else giving the response, a number of those things are going to have to take place. So the hard thing when somebody is doing something new is he has to literally anticipate all the possible things that can be giving a response, and one by one, pick off every one of them to make sure that the response that you're seeing really is coming from the material on the test and nothing else in the environment. So I don't remember seeing that anybody waved around the Geiger counter during that measurement. So was the meter drifting? Is something to worry about. Almost all meters like that do have a DC offset.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Many of them do require a zeroing procedure, and sometimes that zero does drift in time, depending on how high is the performance of the electronics in that meter. Back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
KXJN. Most of the answers for that question could be given by John. At first, he's got an excellent, beautiful piece of the military great equipment, and he could say a lot about it. Now, definitely I've seen in the aftershock. Now, you got to understand, I have used 100% not radioactive material. So, there is none of the chances that emission could come from just radioactivity of the compound set of different elements. It is proven as a fact, and it is related to Army Base Fort Mammoth 1988 experiment of transmutation, that electromagnetic wave could activate the emission. Now, we should talk about beta voltaic, and early pacemakers for the heart use beta voltaic based on promethium. Of course, they were phased out by cheaper lithium ion batteries, but medicine found that technology to be useful. Also, beta voltaic was invented 50 years ago. From other things that I could say about it is that beta voltaic is a power cell that is composed of semiconductors and mildly radioactive materials. The difference is I don't, and I stress I don't use any radioactive material. So when I was talking about Lithuania experiment, I said that I was able to extract, consequently, 60 watts, 150 watts, and 600 watts, and 1 kilowatt of power, which then was done by associate IDA, out of the ferrite ring that was come from a Russian old Rubin TV. And I also said that I have experienced a headache, which was also for the six people in the lab in Lithuania. And we did not know what happened. So now we have. Also, you got to understand that beta voltaic, when you said about the sensitivity of the circuit, we're talking about alpha, beta, and gamma. The presence of gamma was noticed. Alpha could be stopped by a piece of paper. Beta could be stopped by the aluminium sheet. Gamma could be stopped by lead. No trace of gamma was found. Enter here.
Yeah, for the people who are listening, if you can tell them, Wes is doing an experiment which is reproducing a patent that was issued in 1956 by two guys. I think at least one of them is a British scientist, where certain materials are mixed together in a something like a glass tube, a few millimeters in diameter, something like 4.5 centimeters long, and RF energy is excited across the tube, and changes in characteristics take place, and rectification, possible power is being produced, and is this a possible source of greater than unity energy? That's part of what's being analyzed here. And some people will say that, hey, this doesn't obey conservation of energy. It can't possibly be taking place. Others will say, I've seen it. And so since that was a patent filed in 1956, we would like to believe in the 40-some-odd years since then, that where this was a patent in the public domain, where other people could read it and can duplicate it, that you'd like to believe a large number of people have done this, found useful results, and therefore are obeying the, are enjoying the benefits of this. And because I don't hear a lot of track record of people doing it and getting the benefit, it makes believing the claimed performance a little bit difficult, as you can tell. And so this is one of those situations in which you're going to have to anticipate every possible thing that could give the measurement other than what you believe it is, what you would want it to be. You have to get rid of all of the side effects, if you know what I mean. That's going to be a fairly an extensive experiment, as I see it, in order to confirm that it really is what you...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The beta voltaic is the alternative energy generator that is using electrical current in effect of form of battery. And that comes from many scientific sources, including Wikipedia. You can read about it. So it's not new, and it was used in medicine as well.
Now, do you believe, Wes, that this technique is capable of taking inert materials that are non-nuclear active and making them nuclear active? And if so, this in theory could save you a lot of money when it comes to nuclear medicine. In the case of nuclear medicine, they go through an extremely expensive procedure in order to derive the materials that get injected into the human being before you give him a nuclear stress test, which, by the way, I did experience once in my life. They go through an extremely expensive procedure to generate those radioactive materials. Do you believe that this technique of this patent is capable of generating radioactive materials in a much simpler manner than the procedure they go through, which is very expensive? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
But at first, I would like to relate a few things before I go into it. The concentrated microwave is not more dangerous than this, what I was playing with it. But because of the big money that the proper enclosure the scientific exposure was given to that, now microwave is in every house. This thing does not have any permanent radioactivity at all. And we're not really talking about radioactivity. We're talking about the nuclei become unstable, and by that token, the electrical energy being extracted. Now, early experiment, not by me, but recorded, states the beta-voltaic cell sends operating voltage between 100 kilowatts and 1.5 kilowatts in potential. So that's the difference, but let's say that they were, that Army Research Lab in 1954 using this similar material, non-radioactive, were successful in achieving 70 watts output for a short period of time. As early as 1973, beta-voltaic was suggested for use in long-term medical devices as a peacemaker. So we're not talking something that is harmful, we're talking something that is not alive just because of the big money. Nobody's going to make money on it if this thing is to be replicated tonight in your basement. And you'll see it.
Yeah, we've got to be careful about the word microwave. When you're standing in a court of law, or for instance, zoning law, and you're the company that wants to put up a cellular telephone cell site, the word microwave comes up right away, and everyone in the room believes that microwaves are dangerous. And they've got it backwards. When you study the main defining document for the United States, the C-95 report, the report of the IEEE, American National Standards Institute, ANSI, and as I said, that document's been around for 60 years. It's upgraded every couple of years. It represents the best research the United States has ever done at the best testing laboratories and institutions and whatever, universities, on radio frequency biohazard, in other words, RF energy, and whether or not it affects human beings. And it turns out the most dangerous frequency is VHF, 30 to 300 megs. When you get into the microwave region above 1.5 gigahertz, microwaves pound for pound become five times safer than VHF. When you're transmitting 2,000 megacycle energy, so-called microwave energy, and you put a human being in front of that antenna, turns out that 20% of the energy penetrates his body and gets turned into heat. 80% reflects off his skin, whereas at VHF frequencies, 30 to 300, almost all of it gets absorbed. So microwaves actually are safer. People got it backwards. Okay, this, what you're getting into here, Wes, is a fairly far from ham radio subject. It gets into our more serious subjects later on. So I'm going to have to bypass you for now and come back to it later. I'm going to go on to the next person, who was Neil, who I'm pretty sure has a ham radio question. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2RIW. Go ahead, Neil.
Thank you, Dick. This is fairly ham radio related, I guess. I'm trying to really assess the danger of some wires behind my house. We have, where I live, we have underground electrical service, but there are cable and telephone lines strung across the property lines in the back. And I'm wondering if someone on the net knows how much power are actually in those. If they come down, how dangerous they are, or if worst case scenario, a vertical antenna falls on them, what danger do they actually represent?
Now, Neil, let me ask you a little bit of clarification here. And by the way, lots of houses will have an easement behind them where the local wiring for telephone, television, cable TV, and power wiring, 110, 240 volt power wiring, lots of houses will have that as an easement set of poles, utility poles, lined up behind the houses. Most of us have that above ground wiring in front of our house, right on the street. And so in the case of what's in front of my house, for instance, I've got all of the above, and the three wires, the phase A, B, and C, on top of the utility poles that go to the individual transformers that go to the individual houses, that wiring in my house, in my case, is something like 13.5 kilovolts. In some cases, it's 6 kilovolts, but 13.5 kilovolts. And so any kind of an antenna falling across that 13 kilovolts, any kind of conducting object falling across that 13 kilovolts would be very significant. Obvious by the fact that if, as it's happened a couple of times in front of my house, let me drop. If an automobile strikes that pole, brings it down, and one of those 13 kilovolt lines starts touching the ground and starts arcing to the ground, making great big flames and dancing all over the place, you come within 10 feet of that, and your life is at risk. If it happens to dance the wrong way and get near you, you can easily be electrocuted. So it's dangerous as all hell. Any kind of a... We ham radio operators have to make double damn sure that when we're doing anything with our antennas, crank up, fold over, erecting a new antenna, doing the Iwo Jima method of raising your antenna, whatever you're doing, you have to anticipate ahead of time that if there's any technique by which any portion of the conducting substances of your antenna and the support structure, if it falls across the drop that goes to your house, if it falls across the wiring in front of your house, if it falls across the wiring behind your house, you definitely have to plan ahead of time to make darn sure that that doesn't happen. When in doubt, assume all wires are live. Usually the wiring behind the house, like you're describing, is only a 220 volt wiring. It's already got a transformer that's doing the dropping from the 6 kilovolts to 13 kilovolts, which is considered distribution. And then after that, it becomes the pole pick transformer that gives you the 220 volts with center tap, the three wires that go to the individual homes. And in my community, two or three houses are in each one of those pole pick transformers. In some cases, I think they go to three or four houses, all wired together, so to speak, on one transformer. I think your question could be, there's two different things you could be worrying about here, as I see it, Neil. Number one is danger of something falling across it. Number two, you're worrying about any biological effects of the human beings living near the wiring. Also, maybe you're concerned about the reliability of above ground versus underground wiring.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So there's a number of different subjects you could be discussing, Neil. I'll turn it back to you for a little clarification. KD2CM2, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Maybe I didn't state that all that clearly. I'm not at all concerned about the regular AC power supply for the houses. That's all underground. My concern is that there's a cable line, cable feeds, and telephone feeds, and solely cable and telephone feeds. I'm just wondering how much power those actually have in them, and in the event of an accident, what kind of risk they actually represent. Thank you.
Okay, you're one of those very young, lucky guys, as I see it, Neil. I'm going to have to take a look at your call letters and find out. I'm going to do that while I'm talking. I'm going to find out where you live so that I can tell you're one of those very lucky guys that has below ground wiring. Charlie Mike, Quebec. And as such, the power wiring below ground is a lot prettier. But the fact that you still got the wiring above ground for cable TV and telephones and whatever. So Glen Oaks. Huh. I've heard of that place. You live very close to this repeater. The amount of power that's in a cable TV system is in the vicinity of 1 watt. Very small. Doesn't represent any significant danger. If your antenna fell across a cable TV 70-ohm transmission line and broke it, and the line became exposed, and the wiring is now flashing in the air, so to speak, there's only a watt of RF energy flowing down that in that vicinity. And not a great deal of power, because it is distributing radio signals. In the case of a cable TV system, RF type, it's distributing cable TV signals, RF signals, on frequencies between 50 and 500 megacycles approximately. It's distributing that to the front end of television sets, which have got a tremendous sensitivity. A television set front end only needs microwatts or milliwatts of signal, if you know what I mean. It's got 100 and some odd decibels of gain inside. So, therefore, the signal, even though it's going to go to a whole lot of houses with the individual drops, in other words, there's a directional coupler sampling a small amount of the signal flowing down that cable, and it goes to a piece of transmission line that goes to your house, distributes the signal to your house. That's if it's RF.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's if it's RF cable TV. If it's fiber optic, then the signal flowing down there, again, is only milliwatts of signal on the fiber. And if, of course, you fell across that and snapped the fiber, and now the fiber is flashing in your eye, so to speak, it's an extremely small amount of power, relatively safe. So if it's only signaling you're talking about, telephone, television, cable TV, internet connection for computers and whatever, if that's the wiring, as I see it, although you're damaging a vital service and creating interruption of the service, if your antenna fell across it and snapped those wires, and you're going to create a cost impact, and somebody's going to be charging you for doing that. But other than that, the danger to the human beings for something falling across it, as long as there's no power wiring there, no problem. The only thing that has a real electrocution danger, as I see it, is household power wiring. And from what you're saying, that's all underground. Very few communities have got that, and you're one of the very lucky ones. And when it comes to something like Hurricane Sandy, people would like to believe that underground wiring is more reliable. And when it comes to the big picture of what happens on the average year, underground wiring is a lot more expensive, looks pretty, but believe it or not, the history is it's a little bit lower in reliability than above ground wiring. Opposite of common sense. At least I've read that in a few places. Back to you, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec. Try not to hit those wires. KQRIW in the tech net.
Actually, I'm more concerned about the tree branches that when I call the cable company and tell them that their cables are in danger, they tell me to call the telephone company and vice versa. But as far as the underground wiring goes, we have transformers underground also, and every time we get a good rainstorm, one of them explodes because they end up sitting in a flood.
This doesn't completely surprise me, Neil. You're now giving me the details as to why the report of underground wiring being lower in reliability than above ground wiring. You're now giving us the details of what happens. So that if super good planning for flood control is not done in the design of the underground wiring system, water pouring into the transformer creating an explosion is one of the mechanisms by which you lose reliability. So I guess you're saying you have lost power on a couple of occasions because of flooding of that transformer. Is that what you're saying, Neil? Go ahead.
Oh, yes, definitely. They've replaced it. They've rebuilt it. They've done the drains. They've done everything. But during Sandy, we lost power for 5 days till I finally could get everything replaced.
Yeah, in the case of Hurricane Sandy, I think 90-some-odd% of Long Island at one time was without power. Rather than try to list the places that were without power, it would be much easier at the height of Sandy to list the places that had power. And as such, when people called up on the telephone and said, when is my power going to be restored? They wanted to get that answer. They're calling Con Ed and LIPA and LOCO, so to speak. And they didn't get through for very good reason. There was no answer. You couldn't tell ahead of time. I mean, when the whole Don system is down, and all you can do is send out the people you've got to the high priority areas like hospitals and fire stations and police stations. You bring them back up first, and then you start worrying about private homes. So there was no easy answer. And for Governor Cuomo to start making comments that the place must be poorly managed because 90% of the power went out, that's not valid. In my particular case, two of the trees that fell across the road and hit the wiring were 30 feet back on my property. These are 65 and 75-foot high trees, perfectly healthy trees. And you could say, well, they didn't do enough trimming. Are you telling me that they should trim trees that are 30 feet back onto a piece of private property because you anticipate that the tree is going to fall like a pencil and fall across the wiring and fall across the road? I mean, from one point of view, you could call that, in legal language, an act of God, something that you couldn't predict ahead of time. You didn't know that the Super Sandy is going to do that, if you know what I mean. It's a once-per-50-year or once-per-100-year event. We used to think, although maybe these events are starting to happen more frequently. So when it comes to that wiring behind your house, let me drop...
K2YL.
When it comes to that wiring behind your house, I don't think you've got very much to worry about. Let's see what Bernie's got to say about all this. K2IO. Wait for the four beeps, and I didn't do that. K2RW. You got it, Bernie.
Evening, Dick. Just a minor correction. Cuomo was complaining about LIPA's inability to recover. Not that they took the damage, but that they were grossly deficient in the recovery effort. And I am also a very vocal opponent of LIPA's, that I just don't think they did a good job. There were many resources sitting around that they just flat couldn't take advantage of, and that implies they just weren't prepared to plan the recovery system. I met a number of what they call themselves tramp linemen who were basically just sitting around and said that they had nothing they could do because they didn't have resources, didn't have the equipment they needed, didn't have the parts they needed, et cetera, et cetera. So that's specifically what Cuomo was complaining about. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Cuomo can make that complaint. It's very easy to sit up in Albany and throw darts. Okay, what should they have done instead? You can easily say, well, they should have had a greater stockpile in the warehouse of transformers and wires and utility poles and whatever. Okay, as you stock more and more stuff, you pay a higher and higher price. You have to pay a warehousing charge. When you buy the raw material and you put it in the warehouse, it is now purchased material and you pay tax on it. I mean, if you want to run an efficient company, you order the parts in what's called just-in-time. Well, just-in-time, in the case of Sandy, doesn't work. So did they have not enough people? Apparently, you heard a lot, you saw a lot of them that were idle. They had more than enough people. Did they have enough transformers and poles and wiring? Apparently not. So the stockpile in the warehouse wasn't deep enough. However, as they put more and more stuff in the stock in the warehouse, more and more money gets wasted, and therefore it becomes a less efficient operation in between the times when Sandy is going to strike. If you were the president of LIPA to plan for Sandy, what would you have done differently, Bernie? K2IO, K2RIW?
Well, part of the problem is that LIPA is effectively in receivership. They have failed their fiduciary responsibility according to the State Public Utility Commission. So, yes, LIPA is doing better than their previous, what were they called, LOCO, or, whatever the previous iteration was. But LIPA's upper management is just a few steps short of possibly indictment for the gross inadequacy. The PUC is up to their ears in trying to get LIPA straightened out. So there's a lot of problems there.
But my question is, if if you're the head of LIPA and your best weather report is telling you that, hey, something really powerful is coming down on us in 3 days and you're going to get ready for it, what would you do different? Or put it the other way around. In the day-to-day running of the business, are you going to hire more warehouses, buy more stock, and put more stuff into stock and pay more warehousing charge throughout the rest of the years in between these events, between Hurricane Gloria and Hurricane Sandy, and therefore waste a whole lot of money in those in-between years? As I see it, to some degree, you're between a rock and a hard place. What would you do differently, Bernie? I know this is a tough question, KQYO, but you're a smart guy, KQYW.
Actually, the question's not that difficult. You would go to your suppliers. I assume there's a standard transformer that they use a lot of. You go to that supplier and say, what small amount do I have to pay to be able to have access to 10,000 of these things at a moment's notice at a premium price? We're willing to pay the premium price. There was military transport available, so that let's say the manufacturer of these things are out in Wichita, Kansas. As soon as you know that the hurricane's coming, you put them on notice and say, I'm going to need 5,000 of these things, and there's going to be an Air Force transport that's going to come pick it up. And so you make these kind of deals ahead of time. You don't necessarily take possession of them and put them in your own warehouse. You make arrangements with the manufacturer, because sometimes we get hit, sometimes South Carolina gets hit, sometimes Florida gets hit. So I have to assume that the transformer manufacturers are used to these kind of rush emergency orders. Same thing with all of the parts. The lineman that I spoke to knew a week in advance that they were going to be working up here. It wasn't just a spur of the moment, hey guys, come on up here. They knew a week ahead of time. They were already moving up here. Many of them weathered the hurricane either here on Long Island or outside, you know, slightly outside of the area, like up around Poughkeepsie. You know, further, shall we say, 100 miles inland. So these things are very easily dealt with. Emergency, or companies that deal with emergencies do this all the time. It's just a matter of proper planning and being able to have resources at your fingertips when you need them.
KC2QIQ with a comment. Okay, I heard Glenn and then a triple. We'll try to get to these. Bernie, what you said sounds good, but there's a problem. Every other state along the East Coast had the same problem. As Hurricane Sandy walked up the East Coast, you had Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware. They were all being hit with the storm, all ordering those extra transformers, New Jersey, all hitting the small number of vendors simultaneously. I'm guessing the guy who builds that transformer, who builds a reliable transformer, I'm guessing there's only one or two of those vendors. And now all of those states are making the exact same request simultaneously. And what do you and I on Long Island do other than jump up and down and shout louder? How do we prove to them that our need is greater than all those other needs? Because that guy has got a finite manufacturing capability. He can only build those transformers at a certain rate. Yeah, you could say that you wish he could build them at a greater rate. That would mean he's got a much bigger factory with a lot more people, and most of the time they're going to be sitting idle except for these storm situations. So there's a lack of immediate capability of producing more of them at the factory, and a hell of a lot of states needed them all at once. So it was not quite as easy as that, I think. But maybe I'm naive. Glenn, KC2QIQ, how do you see it? K2LIW and the TechNet?
Well, I do know I've read some of the articles that have happened, and there's been a few other things out there that, because now it's all hindsight, it's all 2020. You can look back at what actually happened, and one of the biggest complaints that's been held against LIPA is that they didn't follow the regulations. There was a minimum amount of things that they were supposed to keep on stock, and it was that they had that they're, because they're a public utility, there's certain minimum requirements that they have to have in terms of like poles and things that they're supposed to store, and they're always supposed to be like in recirculation. And also, that was part of it. There were all kinds of things. So in other words, there were violations that in other words, you're saying, the question that you posed to Bernie was, what would you have done differently to in this kind of situation? I think the answer that really, the correct answer to that one would have been, well, follow regulations that are at hand, at least anyway.